The theme of the talk is searching for the fundamental nature of dark matter to try and to understand the microphysical properties of dark matter, but using the larger structures that we have in the universe, the cosmic large-scale structure. And so the fundamental motivation, I should just turn the email ping off. Yeah, the fundamental motivation here for pursuing astrophysical and cosmological tests of the nature of the dark matter is that, you know, there's only one thing we know for certain about the dark matter, which is that it interacts gravitationally with itself and with the visible sector. So there's a huge experimental effort, of course, to either produce or see dark matter directly through colliders, direct and indirect detection. It's conceivable that that effort may just see nothing, and the only way that we can learn something about the nature of the dark matter is through astrophysics and cosmology. And what we can exploit is the fact that depending on the microphysical properties of the dark matter, this does determine how the dark matter evolves and clusters on cosmological scales. So if you can make robust theoretical predictions for how different dark matter models affect cosmological observations, you can confront those predictions with the vast amounts of cosmological CMB and large-scale structure data that we have and that we will be collecting in the next decades and beyond. Now, of course, the challenge that we face is that we can't observe the dark matter directly, but instead we have to trace its large-scale distribution through visible objects. And so in this talk, I will discuss using two particular tracers. The first is the spatial distribution of galaxies, which are tracing the most overdense parts of the dark matter distribution. And at the end, I'll talk secondly about using the gas in between the galaxies through a tracer called the Lyman-Alpha forest, which is tracing the most underdense parts of the dark matter distribution. And I'll talk about the complementarity between these different probes. And so what sort of dark matter models can we consider? So to introduce that, I want to show this plot, which is a version of a plot showing a top-down schematic view of the dark matter model space. There's different classes of dark matter model, and they're ordered by the mass of the new fundamental particle that they would invoke. And traditionally, we have focused our efforts on the WIMP, the weakly interacting massive particle, candidate with a mass around the TeV scale. But because of continuing non-detection of WIMPs at colliders and through direct and indirect detection, that motivates a broadening of the search. So to consider, in addition to the WIMP, well-motivated theoretical alternatives. But then we need new experimental approaches to look for these dark matter candidates. And so in this talk, I'll talk about looking for two particular classes of model. The first is what we call light dark matter. So these are dark matter candidates which are still particle-like in nature, but which are lighter than the traditional WIMP, so mass is less than the proton below the GeV scale. And I'll also talk, for the majority of the talk, about this ultralight regime. And so here, as the mass of the dark matter particle becomes lighter, its de Broglie wavelength becomes larger, and so its wave-like nature becomes relevant to terrestrial and astronomical observation. So just to, what is the state of dark matter searches? So this is a recent summary of experimental probes for WIMP dark matter. So everything in green is what is excluded, 90% confidence. For the WIMP nucleon cross-section on the y-axis, the function of the WIMP mass, going from GV to TeV masses. And you can see that, there's been extraordinary progress in the last, even since I started doing my PhD, in the last 10 years, excluding smaller and smaller cross-sections. And we reach the prospect of reaching this experimental limit and our ability to look for WIMP dark matter, which is this neutrino flaw. So this orange curve here, for cross-sections smaller than that, then your signal becomes indistinguishable from the neutrino flux in your direct detection experiments. And so the solid lines are projected sensitivities from currently operating and planned experiments. And you know, I went to a dark matter conference a couple of weeks ago, and they're already talking about using direct detection experiments as neutrino observatories. So this is a real prospect that they're facing. Now you'll see that even for future experiments, the sensitivity for masses below a GeV drops precipitously. And that's fundamentally because when using direct detection, you typically have some tank of some target nucleus. You sit and you wait for your dark matter particle to hit it, give it a little kick, create a scintillation. And as the dark matter gets lighter, the kick it gives is weaker, and so it's harder to produce that scintillation signal. And so traditional direct detection experiments lose the ability to search for these light dark matter candidates. But if you go to the very early universe, when the universe is hotter and denser, then depending on the cross-section, interactions between dark matter and the baryons can become extremely abundant. And so what would happen is that you would introduce a coupling between the dark matter and baryon fluids, and the dark matter would act as a source of drag on this coupled fluid. And what you would do is you would collisionally dampen the growth of perturbations in this coupled fluid below some characteristic scale. And so what this plot is showing you is the scale of that suppression. So at scales at and below this, you will suppress the growth of structure. So going from kiloparsecs to gigaparsecs, and how it depends on the proton dark matter cross-section and the dark matter mass, we're extending to these sub-GeV masses. And the key point here is that if you want to access smaller cross-sections, you want to improve your sensitivity, you need to access smaller scales in the cosmic density field. And so we'll talk about how the Lyman Alpha Forest gives us the ability to access the smaller scales we currently can in the linear matter power spectrum, and how that can set the most competitive bounds currently on those sub-GeV models. Okay, so I said that also we will discuss searches for ultralight candidates. So these extremely light particles. So here I define an ultralight particle to be anything with a mass less than 10 to the minus 18 electron volts. So then you have an astrophysically large, kiloparsec and larger sized wavelength. From fundamental theory, I will argue that, you know, there's no particular prior on the mass across this range, but there are mass scales of interest which have astrophysical motivation. So there's a long-standing interest in a mass scale of 10 to the minus 22 electron volts, what I call a canonical mass scale, which has been for a long time invoked to resolve apparent discrepancies in the standard cold dark matter, so-called small-scale crisis. And I'll also talk about a lighter mass scale at 10 to the minus 25 electron volts. So we'll have a larger, around 10 megaparsec wavelength, and how this may be relevant to addressing discrepancies in another discrepancy in the cosmological model called the S8 tension. Okay, so.
Sorry, can I ask? Sorry,
please, yeah.
When you say not to a scale, what do you mean there?
Just that this mass scale is not to scale. The axis along.
The actual numbers.
Yeah, exactly. Okay. So what is an axion? So to illustrate the sort of dynamics of having these ultralight particles, so I will usually refer to these ultralight axions. Axions are a particular particle physics motivation, but all the results I will show you would apply generically to any ultralight scalar particle. And so the axion dynamics is sort of illustrated schematically here for one of the sort of simplest constructions of its potential. So at some early time, you have the axion field. Up here, it'll drop into the rim of this hat-shaped potential, have some axial degree of freedom, hence its name. And then at some later time, that symmetry will break and the axion will start to oscillate around the bottom of that potential. And so that sets up two regimes in its dynamics. At early times, the axion is slow rolling towards the bottom of that potential. It'll have an equation of state of minus one, and it will drive a phase of accelerated expansion. So it's behaving like dark energy at those times. And at some later time, As the expansion rate h drops below the oscillation time, the oscillations will take over, and then in a time average state sense, the equation of state is zero, and it's behaving like a pressureless cold dark matter fluid. But if this mass is light enough in this ultralight regime, it'll have this astrophysically sized wavelength. And so it'll produce wave-like phenomena in structure formation that distinguishes it from standard cold dark matter. And so what you'll notice is that the time of this oscillation depends on the mass of the axion, such that if you consider the very lightest axions, so less than 10 to the minus 27 electron volts, this transition occurs after the epoch of matter radiation equality. And so it's behaving like dark energy to late cosmic times, and it'll have some degeneracy with the dark energy content. All the axions that we consider have begun oscillating by today, so they all contribute to the dark matter today, but if they're less than 10 to the minus 27 EV, they are dark energy-like beyond matter radiation equality. If you get below 10 to the minus 33 electron volts, the axion has not started oscillating, and so it's indistinguishable from a cosmological constant. That's sort of the lower limit to which we can consider these ultralight particles. For masses greater than 10 to the minus 27 EV, this transition occurs in the very early universe, and only the dark matter-like properties of the particle are relevant to observation. So we have these two different regimes that will create different effects in our observables and different constraints as a consequence. And where can you motivate these particles from? Well, quite fairly generically, axion-like particles are abundantly produced in high-energy theories. Typically, we motivate these ultralight particles from string models, where you have the concept of the string axiverse, the idea that you'll produce many different axions, each of different masses, arises from the space-time compactification, and one or more of these stringy axions are viable dark matter candidates. And so this plot here is a calculation of the number of axions that is produced for different space-time compactification manifolds. It's a frequency plot. So it's the number of times you get these Hodge numbers, which are these geometric numbers describing the manifolds, relates directly to the number of axions you produce. And you see, typically, you expect to produce on the order of tens to hundreds of these particles. And so we take that as motivation on our work, not just to consider the case where there's a single axion which is the entirety of the dark matter, but to consider these mixed dark matter models. So in particular, these axions will have a range of ultralight and heavy masses, and when they behave, if the heavier axions are contributing to the dark matter, they will have microscopic wavelengths, and so they'll be indistinguishable from cold dark matter. And so we consider these mixed ultralight axion and cold dark matter models.
So I'm sorry, I mean, have multiple axions, I guess, being important, take some fine-tuning, right?
Right. So I'm not making any statement, you know, this is just producing axions. I'm not making any statement about any tuning required to promote them to dark matter abundance. I'm just model agnostic and say, let's just see what fraction of the dark matter can sit in a scalar of any mass. But yeah, I accept your point. Okay. So when you have these ultralight particles, what are the signatures that you see in structure formation? So these are some results from some simulations, hydrodynamical simulations of structure formation. The top for standard cold dark matter, which we can associate with something like the WIMP. The bottom for these ultralight scalar dark matter, which we often call fuzzy dark matter because of these wave-like properties they have. And there's two key features. So the first is shown in the left-hand plot, where you see that in the fuzzy dark matter case, you have these smoother filaments and much less small-scale structure, and that's because you're suppressing the growth of structure below the de Broglie wavelength of the particle. So this is simulated here for 10 to the minus 22 electron volts. So you're suppressing roughly below megaparsec scales, depending on the velocity. But these results are generic for any mass less than about 10 to the minus 18 electron volts. It's just that the scale at which these features manifest is a function of the axion mass. So if I make the axion lighter, this suppression happens on larger scales. And this suppression will be traced by gaseous and stellar components of the universe. But if you zoom in on the higher density regions, so in the halos and filaments, here you have a sort of smoking gun signature of fuzzy dark matter, which is these classical wave interference fringes. And this is just interference occurring from these collective excitations of this wave dark matter field, and they will just classically interfere with each other, and you produce these very distinctive order density one fringes. And this is distinguishing, right, from other models that will also smooth out the small scale structure, like warm dark matter or those interacting dark matter models I showed you earlier. Okay, so as I said earlier, we want to scan across the full range of ultralight masses that we can consider. So that is 10 to the minus 33 up to 10 to the minus 18 electron volts. But there are astrophysically interesting mass scales of interest. So in particular, ultralight axions of 10 to the minus 22 electron volts are invoked to resolve the so-called cold dark matter small scale crisis. So that's the collection of discrepancies between the predictions of cold dark matter only simulations and observations at galactic and subgalactic scales. Includes traditionally the cusp core problem, where the DM only simulations are predicting these divergent density profiles at the centers of dark matter halos, whereas observations are preferring these shallower chord-like density profiles. And historically, we had the missing satellites problem, where we observed many fewer Milky Way satellite galaxies than was predicted in these DM only simulations. And so axions being the dark matter at this mass were invoked to resolve these problems because first, these particles have to be bosonic in nature to have enough occupation. And so you produce Bose-Einstein condensates at the center of halos, these soliton objects that are invoked to reproduce these chord-like profiles. And you would address the missing satellites problem because you would simply suppress the growth of low mass subhalos that would host these Milky Way satellites below their De Broglie wavelength. Now, there's been a lot of work demonstrating in the last few years that more sophisticated implementation of astrophysical processes in galaxy and subgalactic structure formation is key to understanding these issues. So in particular, one can produce cores in low mass galaxies through astrophysical processes, for example, supernova feedback. And we now have a much more complete observational census of the Milky Way satellite population, which is more in agreement with the predictions from simulations. But what that really means is that now we can turn this problem around and use our ability to make high fidelity predictions for the effect of different dark matter models on small and large scale structure formation to put empirical bounds on the nature of the dark matter. And that is the approach that we're taking in this work. Okay, but I want to bring up another tension in the cosmological model, and that's the S8 discrepancy. So S8 is a cosmological parameter. It's a measure of the amplitude of fluctuations in the dark matter density when averaged over 8 megaparsec scales. And the plot here is a recent summary plot I pulled from a Snowmass paper. It shows measurements of S8 from different cosmological experiments. And what you see at the top in blue is measurements from CMB experiments. And these prefer these systematically higher values of S8 than you see in various large-scale structure experiments, so from galaxy surveys. So the significance of this is around a 3 sigma. But it seems to be independent of experiment. So you see consistently high values of S8 independently in Planck and in ACT and WMAP. And I think last week we saw ACT alone also likes these high values of S8. And we see low values of S8 independently in galaxy weak lensing, in galaxy clustering, and in galaxy cluster cosmology. And so solutions to this from new physics typically invoke they point out that this is an early versus late universe discrepancy. That's to say that these CMB experiments are largely probing fluctuations in the early universe. And so solutions typically involve some sort of decay in the nature of the dark matter. So you would have something called dark matter at early times. It would decay into some products which are suppressing structure formation only at late times. But another way to think about this is in terms of large versus small scales. So that's to say that currently, the CMB experiments were only modeling on relatively large linear scales, whereas, and so you're not directly measuring S8, is the point I want to make. So you are measuring amounts of clustering on relatively large scales, assuming cold dark matter, predicting an amount for S8, and then that amount is higher than the amount of clustering you more directly measure in these galaxy surveys. And so what that suggests is that if you had some sort of scale-dependent suppression arising from the nature of the dark matter, you may be able to simultaneously fit the CMB and galaxy survey information.
Wait, sorry, so just to clarify for me, like, so when you say that this is only on small scales, like what sort of k's are you talking about?
So k greater than 0.2 inverse megaparsec. I have a plot that I think will illustrate that better. Yeah, exactly. Yeah. But just to reiterate the point, so I'm suggesting that a scale-dependent suppression can fit the CMB and large-scale structure data, and that's precisely what a model like Axions can do, right? So you will suppress the growth of structure below a characteristic gene scale, which depends on redshift Z, axion density omega A, and the mass of the particle M. And you can see that if you have a particle around 10 to the minus 26, 10 to the minus 25 electron volts, you'll suppress structure growth around 8 to 10 megaparsecs, precisely the scale where we want to lower the amount of clustering in the cosmic structure. And so you can see that effect in the linear matter power spectra in the plot here. So the top I show linear matter power, increasing axion mass left to right. In the bottom I show the ratio to the cold dark matter limit, where I'm increasing the fraction of the dark matter sitting in axions from 0 up to 8%. And so there's two key effects here when we're looking for axion dark matter. The first is that as they increase the axion mass, the Du Bois wavelength gets smaller, and so the wave number of suppression gets larger. And as they increase the amount of axions at a given mass, the suppression at a given wave number gets stronger. And so we have these two non-degenerate effects that we're looking for when constraining the mass and density of these ultralight particles. And so I think to come to Neil's point, this plot hopefully makes it clearer. So how exactly do axions affect S8? So again, on the top here, I'm showing linear matter power. In the bottom, I'm showing the ratio to the cold dark matter limit. The colored lines are for different values of the axion mass and energy density. And then in gray, I'm showing you the range of scales which S8 is probing. So S8 through sigma 8 is an integral of the linear matter power times the kernel you see in gray, which is the Fourier transform of a top hat filter with an 8 megaparsec radius. It's this Bessel function. The black dashed line shows the maximum wave number probed by the Planck CMB analysis. And you can see that it's not probing all the scales to which S8 is sensitive. Okay, but the black dotted line shows the maximum wave number probed by the BOSS galaxy clustering analysis that we carry out. And that is more directly probing the 8 megaparsec scales that S8 is sensitive to. Please.
Completely naive question.
Yeah.
So in a galaxy survey, how do you measure S8? Do you actually put down 8 megaparsec size spheres in the volume and average them, and that's S8, or is it some derivative, some like derived quantity from measuring from the power spectrum or something? Just like in practice, how do you get?
So there's different ways of doing your analysis. So you could do like a correlation function analysis, which would be closer to what you're talking about. What we use is the galaxy power spectrum. So you just, yeah, you, it's just the cosmological parameters that you fit to your galaxy power spectrum. And so hopefully you can see, so if the axon is too light, okay, it has to have a small fraction because you can't have large-scale suppression. You have to maintain consistency with the CMB data on large scales. If the axion is too heavy, the wave number of your suppression is on too small scales to affect S8. Yeah?
Well,
think this confused me more because, I mean, of course, I mean, if you just measure galaxy correlation function, it's degenerate bias. So you have to, I guess, use redshift space distortion to infer SA.
Yeah.
But then that's not the K max of the power spectrum that you care about. It's the K max of RSD or something like that. And I'm just wondering whether it would be misleading to look at this K max of the power spectrum.
You were right. So there's not, we're getting into the mildly nonlinear scales. So there will be couplings to even higher K here. So that is correct, yeah. But it won't apply to the CMB lensing analysis because that's a linear only analysis. Yeah.
Okay, thanks.
That makes sense. But there's a sweet spot, right? So when you have axions around 10 to the minus 26, 10 to the minus 25 EV, you can maintain consistency with the CMB data on large scales and suppress structure around 8 megaparsecs and fit the galaxy data better. So this is the hypothesis, and I will show you the results of the full analysis.
So is that part time dependent? I mean, super high redshift,
yeah.
One or two or three or something,
yeah.
Do you expect this to be the same?
Yes, right. So axions have a rather weak dependence on redshift. To the power of 1/4. So there's some time dependence, but it is qualitatively different from those decaying dark matter models. So we're essentially making a different prediction, right? That there'll be small scale suppression even at high redshift. Yeah. Okay, I want to make a brief interlude into some of the methodological work that we've been doing as well. So, one of the challenges that we faced in doing this analysis is that, making the theoretical calculations that we need to, the effective axions in these observables can be more time consuming than in the standard lambda CDM case. So we wanted to exploit some machine learning methods to see if we could accelerate this analysis. So we'll talk a little bit about building some emulators. So when we're looking for the effect of different physics, different dark matter models on the things that we observe, you can think of it as a mapping like this, right? We're going from a mapping from some input parameters. So I have the baseline 6 parameters in lambda CDM, the density and mass of axions. You could have further extensions. So for example, you might want to vary the initial field displacement for the axion field. And we have robust theoretical calculations for how these affect things we can measure, like the CMB angular power spectra or the linear matter power spectrum. And so in the lambda CDM case, we have codes like CAM, takes around a second to make each evaluation. When we do inference, we want to sample a posterior, we have to run an MCMC chain, we have to run hundreds of thousands of CAM evaluations, and now your chain can take a few hours to converge. In the axion CAM case, this can be an order of magnitude slower. So now your chains can take a few days each to converge. And if you add further new physics to these extreme axions, it can be another order of magnitude slower. Now your chains take weeks to converge. And of course, we don't run these chains once. We run them with different priors, different data cuts. We have bugs that we have to fix. So you can see that quite quickly, this what becomes the limiting factor here is our time of computation to do these theoretical calculations. So we took this idea, which has been used in cosmology, of taking a machine learning model, asking it to learn the mapping from input parameters to output observables. So here we're using neural networks. We train it on a bank of evaluations of our axion CAM codes. And once it's trained, it's essentially instantaneous to evaluate these power spectra. So we can take a tiny fraction of a second to generate a power spectra across the parameter space we want to explore. And so then what becomes your limiting factor is actually the linear algebra in your likelihood function. So if you combine your theory emulator, rewrite your likelihood function in a code like TensorFlow, which means that you can do your linear algebra on the GPU instead of the CPU. You also combine that with GPU-accelerated MCMC samplers. You can get the results on the left. So here, we're generating posterior contours given Planck data for lambda CDM and axion parameters. in black is using standard CPU Axion CAM and a CPU-based MC sampler. And in red is using the neural network emulator and a GPU sampler. And we can exactly reproduce these contours, but rather than taking 30 hours to converge, it takes just 10 seconds. So we get this huge speed up in our ability to do the data analysis that we want to do. And so, you know, this is a huge benefit to the ability to doing cosmological data analysis, but I'd also point out that this will become increasingly necessary because the architectures that we're using are becoming more GPU dominant. And so CPU allocations are being cut, more GPUs are being put into these architectures, and we need to be ready to use this this new architecture, but also benefit from it in the process.
Do you understand why like so many of the contours have these like curvy C shapes instead of roses?
So what you're seeing is the degeneracy between omega CDM and omega Axion, essentially. So this is for a mass. It would be like a dark matter-like axion mass. And so then you have a strong degeneracy between omega axion and omega CDM. And so when that projects into all these planes, that's when you get these curved.
Degeneracy is not just like some straight line, it's some curvy line?
It's like half of an ellipse.
Oh, am I seeing this wrong?
Yeah, so here is where is your sort of lambda CDM value of the CDM, and then that's the degenerate part with axions, right? Yeah. So it's kind of like a hard line at one end because that's your sort of lambda CDM limit, and then you go. Yeah. Okay, so let's get back to the data analysis that we did. So we set out to look for these ultralight axions across this ultralight regime, and we wanted to take information from CMB and galaxy surveys. Okay, so first we took all the CMB data that we have access to, so data from Planck, from ACT, DR4, and SPT, temperature and polarization CMB angular power spectrum, and the Planck lensing power spectrum at the bottom. In black, so the points of the data, the black solid line is our maximum posterior model. And I point out the black dotted line where I've injected an axion of 10 to the minus 27 electron volts, being 100% of the dark matter today. So that's one of these dark energy-like axions. And you can see that you're going to get strong constraints already for these dark energy-like axions from the CMB, in particular from the primary CMB spectra, because you're changing the ratio of matter to radiation in the early universe. You'll change the position and amplitude of the acoustic oscillations in the CMB. And because these are dark matter-like today, but they are very light, and so they have these very large wavelengths, you'll see very large-scale suppression in the CMB lensing potential. So already from the CMB, we're getting very strong constraints for masses at and below 10 to the minus 26 electron volts. And I'll show you the full constraints in a few slides' time. But what does this leave for us to address the S8 discrepancy? So to illustrate that, I want to show you a triangle plot of the marginalized posteriors on S8, the matter energy density, the axion density. First, I want to show you the lambda CDM results. So in blue, we take a combination of all that CMB data. We also add galaxy baryon acoustic oscillation information, so large-scale 100 megaparsec fluctuations in the galaxy distribution. Also supernova magnitudes in blue. And first, if I take you to the omega M S8 plane, you see the S8 discrepancy as it stands. So it wants higher values of S8 than you get in these fiducial photometric galaxy survey analyses from Dark Energy Survey and KIDS, these 3x2. That's the combination of galaxy clustering and galaxy weak lensing information. And they want these lower values of S8. But if I reanalyze that large-scale data set, so CMB, BAO, and supernova, allow for an axion of 10 to the minus 25 electron volts to contribute, I can easily recover these lower values of S8. And that's being driven by this degeneracy with the axion energy density, Whereas I increase the amount of axions, I'm suppressing power at 8 megaparsecs and get lower values of S8. Now, what this is really telling you is that this large-scale data set is insensitive to the presence of axions of this mass. The suppression is on smaller scales than can be constrained by these data. So I can be up to 100% of the dark matter sitting in an axion of this mass, and I can get these low values of S8. Now, to really see if you've restored consistency between these data sets, you then need to reanalyze the clustering and weak lensing information under this extended model to see if you have consistency between all these data under the same model. Jesse.
Yeah, I'm curious, so looking at the axion S8 curve, or just the axion constraints, it looks like you have kind of weak upper and lower bounds. Are those prior volume things, or are you actually able to put some weak constraints on that?
So yeah, it peaks slightly away from zero, but with no significance that I would subscribe to it, essentially. So essentially for masses at 10 to the minus 25 and above, we have no sensitivity to these ultralight particles. All the constraint is at 10 to the minus 26 and below. Yeah.
So to follow up, you know, Swanya Aisha's question before about RSV, like, so here, are you just only fitting the monopole, or are you also trying to match?
So there's no galaxy power spectrum here. It's just the galaxy BAO so far. But that leads me to the next thing. So as I was saying, you know, to really assess if you've got consistency, you have to reanalyze the galaxy clustering and the galaxy weak lensing information. So I'm going to show you the results of doing the galaxy clustering analysis. So we take the galaxy survey from the SDSS. It's nice to show this movie, which is showing you real data. So each point is the position of a galaxy or quasars at high redshift mapped into our observable volume. We're sat at the middle. The color coding is just different sub-surveys within the larger SDSS. And hopefully as we fly through the data, you'll see that the galaxy distribution already is tracing out the filamentary structure of the universe. It's tracing the dark matter distribution. And so hopefully you can get the sense that you can look for the effects of deviations from cold dark matter in this galaxy data. If you're changing this filamentary structure from something like ultralight axions, it'll show up in this galaxy distribution. Now, we want to go beyond these BAO-only analyses. So previously I showed you just, you know, measurement of the BAO peak. Here we want to use the full galaxy power spectrum, okay? And so that means that we need to go beyond the linear-only physics that we've had before, but into the mildly non-linear regime. And so to do that, we're going to use the effective field theory of large-scale structure. So I'm just going to show you a schematic view of how this model works. So what we're modeling on the left here is the galaxy power spectrum. It's functional wave number k. It's an isotropic. We have retro space distortions. So we do a multipole expansion indexed by L. We have a set of terms. So the first set of terms captures the existing linear theory. We then have a set of terms that capture higher order perturbations to the galaxy distribution. We go up to one loop in order. We have a set of terms that are ultraviolet counter terms. So they're capturing the effects of short scale physics back on these longer wavelength modes that we're measuring. We have a set of terms that capture stochastic effects like shot noise and nonlinear registrase distortion. So this is included in our model. We account for infrared resummation and the Alcock potential distortion. But the key point here is that the functional form of each of these terms depends only on the linear matter power spectrum. And so that means that we can capture the effect of small deviations from CDM, these small contributions of axions that we're looking for, through modified linear matter power spectrum. But we then have to change, we'll have different galaxy biases, different amplitudes of these correction terms. So we have to re-marginalize the amplitude of each of these corrections. And so we have a set of nuisance parameters that we have to marginalize over when looking for the effect of these axions.
Is the form of each of these terms the same in these axion universes as it is in normal polar matter?
So in these small contributions, within the tolerance that we have, that is a true statement. If you have very large contributions, then there can be deviations. Yeah, so what's interesting is that most of the effects happens below the De Broglie wavelength. But that's precisely the regime where the power spectrum is suppressed. So you can calculate the corrections from things like quantum pressure, but they basically get exponentially suppressed because they're in the part of the power spectrum that is going to zero. And so the back reaction to the longer wavelength modes ends up being negligible.
I can still imagine that the k-dependence of some of these like loop terms, for example, might be different in these axion models, especially because you're working on scales around the de Broglie wavelength, right?
Yeah. Yeah, so you can, you know, this, it's the same sort of arguments as we have in these neutrino cosmologies, where it's been shown that, you know, with the tolerance of the data that we have, these, the functional forms do not change in these extended models. Okay. So what's the effect of axions on the galaxy power spectrum? So this is, now the galaxy power spectrum, I'm showing the monopole at the top, quadrupole at the bottom. Again, increasing axion mass left to right. And then the fraction of a dark matter sitting in axions from 0 to 8%. Okay? And the first point is that for these two lightest axions, here the de Broglie wavelength of these very light axions is larger than the volume of the survey we have. So this is modeled for BOSS galaxy data. And so what happens is that you suppress all wave numbers within your survey equally by the same amount. And so it's degenerate with an overall amplitude rescaling of the power spectrum. But then if you go to a heavier axion, so mass around 10 to the minus 26 EV, the de Broglie wavelength falls within the volume of your survey. And you can see the scale-dependent effect in the galaxy power spectrum. And so we expect increased sensitivity to heavier axions, in particular for modeling smaller scales in the galaxy data than we are in the CMB data at the moment. And so these are the data that we confront with. So this is the galaxy power spectrum, functional wave number k. We are modeling the monopole, quadrupole, the next non-zero component, the hexadecapole. On smaller scales, we're conservative in how we model nonlinear redshift space distortions. So instead, we reconstruct the real space galaxy power spectrum. So we project away the redshift space distortions and only model the real space contribution to the galaxy power spectrum. So that's this green component, which we call Q0. In the solid line is our maximum likelihood model. We can have a good fit to the data. And then the black dashed line, this time I've injected an axion of 10 to the minus 25 electron volts, 75% of the dark matter. And you can see the scale-dependent suppression on small scales. In particular, access to these smaller scales is increasing our sensitivities at these masses. Okay, so we can get constraints on these ultra axions independently from CMB and from galaxy surveys. But the strongest constraints will come from combining these data sets. But before we do, of course, we have to check if we have improved consistency between these data under this extended model. So here I'm showing you constraints on S8 and omega m, the left for lambda CDM, the right for ultralight axions, here for 10 to the minus 25 electron volts. On the left, again, you see the S8 tension. So in yellow is the Planck constraint. It wants these high values of S8. Then we get in the BOSS galaxy power spectrum and also in the combination of the power spectrum and bispectrum from BOSS. If I allow this axion of 10 to the minus 25 electron volts, in particular with the CMB data, I can get to lower values of S8 and I have much more overlap in these posterior contours. So I have more consistency under axions than lambda CDM between these different data sets. So the S8 tension goes from 3 to 1.5 sigma. And importantly, we check the consistency, not just in this plane, but in the full multi-dimensional posterior distribution. So we check the overlap between the full high-dimensional posteriors, and it's always improved under these axion models better than under lambda CDM. Okay, so, yeah, please.
So in the previous slide,
yeah.
Where you say an axion of 10 to the minus 25, do you assume that it's the dark matter or some?
Yeah, so generically, we never assume anything. We just allow an energy density of axions to contribute, and there'll be a CDM component and a dark energy component. For this mass, you're well into the dark matter-like only regime, so it'll be entirely degenerate with the cold dark matter. So when you have 100% axions, you'll have no cold dark matter. So these are contributing to the dark matter density.
I'm just asking, this axion, how much of the dark
matter? Yeah, so for the CMB here, you're essentially going from zero up to 100% here.
Okay, but 100% is excluded at these masses, right?
Not by CMB data, but it will be by the BOS data. So we don't see a contribution of axions in the CMB and galaxy survey data. So we set an upper limit on the axion energy density. And so at 10 to the minus 25 electron volts, the combined constraint from Planck and BOS, you can have it be around 50% of the dark matter sitting in a scalar of 10 to the minus 25 electron volts. Say that again. Fifty percent. Yeah.
Yeah, but his point is that those fractions are also ruled out by other things, just like the existence of galaxies rules out those sort of mass fractions.
So it won't, right? Because you still have 50% of the dark matter sitting in a cold dark matter component, and so you can produce Milky Way-sized galaxies. You'll just have a component of the density sitting in a component that doesn't cluster, right?
So then is also then ruled out just by galaxy dynamics, right?
So to be clear, these axions are so light that their wavelength is larger than the size of a galaxy. So they simply won't contribute to...
Yeah, I mean, right. Yeah, so for this 10 to the minus 25, yeah, that's right. But for masses like 10 to the minus 24, 23, 22,
yeah,
it's ruled out just by stellar kinematics inside of a range of galaxies.
Yes. So I agree with that statement, right? So for heavier axions beyond what we're considering here, then there are constraints from probes like that. But for these ultralight scalars, so at 10 to the minus 25 EV and below, you can have a significant fraction of the dark matter sitting in these ultralight masses. That's consistent with these data. So I will come to Lyman alpha first, but essentially, yes, because we don't, again, these axions are so light that their wavelengths are larger than what we're currently modeling in Lyman alpha forest surveys.
But the suppression won't be there anyways of the power spectrum, right? So.
Yeah, so a key point here, right, is that you need to see the scales. It comes back to this one, right? If your survey volume is smaller than the De Broglie wavelength of your particle, then you'll just degenerate with an amplitude rescaling. And so the effect of your scalar becomes washed up by other things like the amplitude of the power spectrum or galaxy bias, for example. You really need your survey to see the scale-dependent suppression to put some constraint on these models.
So for a 50% mass fraction, so how much is the suppression of the power spectrum on these scales?
It's sort of 10, 20%.
No, 50%.
Yeah.
No, I mean, so on the scales of galaxy formation scales.
Yes, 10, because it's pretty flat, right? So we go back here. It's pretty flat in the power spectrum.
Well, sorry, but show that again. So yellow is 10%. Mass fraction, and yellow is a 50% suppression of the power spectrum.
Right, that's in the linear matter power spectrum.
So if I change that from 8% to 50%, it should be a much, even stronger suppression than this 40-50% suppression of the power spectrum.
Yes, but it doesn't scale linearly with the density, right? So it's scaling to the minus 1/4.
Gene scale. So I mean the suppression of the amplitude of the power spectrum.
Yeah.
That should scale, I would imagine, linearly or even steeper with the mass fraction. And so again, 50% seems like it'll just wipe out the existence of galaxies.
So I don't have the exact amount of suppression, but there is power on smaller scales for those axions.
Yeah. And so if you go from 8% to order 50%, it's going to be an even larger suppression of the power.
It will be a larger suppression, but it really doesn't scale linearly all the way to 100%, right? Because
if you want to have any galaxies forming, you cannot have order one suppression of the amplitude of the power spectrum.
I disagree. So I think, you know, there is a dark, you need some power on small scales to produce galaxies. And you do have some power in these models, right?
Okay, we can talk more.
Yeah, okay. I mean, the key point I want to make is you have degeneracy. If your data is not probing the scales where there's scale-dependent suppression, then you have degeneracy of other parameters that can inject power, right? So to put a you can only put a constraint on these models where you see the scale dependent suppression.
I don't understand that. So I mean, like, yeah, so we know from the CMB that at K of 0.05, K of 0.1, you know, the power spectrum is the amplitude of the power spectrum is what we expect from, you know, from the CMB normalization.
Yeah.
So given that constraint on the amplitude at scales slightly larger than this, I don't see then how you can tolerate then having like order 50%, order 80-90% suppression of the amplitude of the power spectrum, and then still form galaxies, right?
Yeah, so.
The scale structure will look completely different, right? You know, so we'd have like enormous filaments instead of having like galaxies, right? Because you change the shape of the power spectrum enormously.
Yeah.
Anyway, yeah.
We can talk about this afterwards. I maintain that there is power on small scales, so you could still proceed with galaxy formation, right? Yeah.
Okay, but you agree that the suppression will be of order like 90% of the power spectrum, something like that, right? Just based off of what you're showing here.
So the exact dependence, I don't know, but I'm not sure it'd be 90%, right? Okay. So then you can update this plot, right? Marginalized posteriors on S8, omega m, axion energy density, and you can't get to such low values of S8, but you can still, you know, with small fractions of axions, get to lower values of S8 consistent with this Planck and Boss data. Okay. And so the final piece here, so, you know, I think the point I want to make is there's not finished story, right? You need to fold in all the data that you have. And so what we'd like to fold in is the galaxy weak lensing information as well, which is probing these nonlinear scales. Okay. And so here we had a preliminary analysis of galaxy shear correlation function from the dark energy survey. But here we limited ourselves to the case where a single axion is the entirety of the dark matter. Okay, and so here you can rule that out. So we set a lower limit on the axion mass at around 10 to the minus 23 electron volts. And so the next step here is, of course, to extend this to these mixed models and accurately determine the viability of these mixed dark matter models. Okay. I'll talk briefly about some of the Lyman alpha forest stuff. So the idea here is, okay, we have a loose sensitivity to these axions around 10 to the minus 25 electron volts and above from the CMB and galaxy survey data. You want to look for heavier axions, the de Broglie wavelength is smaller. And so there you need to go beyond the galaxy survey information because this is hard to model on very small nonlinear scales. And so what you can use is the Lyman alpha forest, which is an absorption feature formed in the IGM. And in particular, it's coming from gas sitting around mean cosmic density. And so it's much less affected by nonlinearities to small scales than galaxy surveys, which are probing these very high density regions of the universe. Now, the challenge is when looking for now very small scale sub-megaparsec suppressions, you are sensitive to the astrophysical state of the intergalactic gas. Okay? And so in particular, you have to marginalize over the extent to which the gas is heated through the process of cosmic reionization. Now, we can do that with simulations. You can run hydrodynamical simulations. These take an order of 3,000 CPU hours per simulation. So now when you do your MCMC analysis, the emulator is essential, right? You have to have some way of more efficiently mapping from your input parameters to your output observables than running hundreds of thousands of these expensive simulations. So again, now we build an emulator, but now it really is essential to the analysis. Okay. So first, we look in the Lyman Alpha Forest data for these dark matter proton interactions. These are the data that we're looking in. So this is the Lyman Alpha Forest power spectrum at high redshift from 4.2 to 5. Function of wave number k. And in particular, I highlight the black line is showing you the smaller scale that was previously used to set dark matter bounds using Lyman Alpha Forest data. Okay, and so by having access to this additional small scale information, you can look for suppression arising from heavier axions and smaller dark matter cross sections. So we use the emulator to model that Lyman Alpha Forest data. We see no evidence, even after marginalizing over the precious moving scale of the gas, for any suppression arising from these dark matter interactions. So you can set an upper limit on the proton dark matter cross section, shown in green. So everything above is excluded. And in particular, I highlight the complementarity of these cosmological constraints to current direct detection constraints, which lose sensitivity above a GEV, and this really sets the upper baseline for new technologies that are being developed to look for these lighter dark matter models. Okay, and then we re-optimize this emulator to look for suppression arising from axions. And again, we find no evidence for suppression. Here again, this analysis is limited to the case where a single axion is the entirety of the dark matter. We set a lower limit on the axion mass at 2 times 10 to minus 20 electron volts. So this combined with results from the satellite galaxy distribution. Neil more recently also showed constraints from stellar kinematics. I think all combined strongly rules out this canonical mass scale of 10 to the minus 22 electron volts. So dark matter solutions to the small scale crisis are incompatible with these different data sets that we have. So let me finish by bringing it all together. So these are all the constraints on the axion energy density. It's a function of axion mass. We have the CMB, galaxy survey constraints at light mass, Lyman Alpha Forest, and small scale satellite structure on the heavy end. And all taken together, you cannot have a single axion be the entirety of the dark matter all the way up to around 10 to the minus 20 electron volts. But there is the possibility to have small fractions of the dark matter sitting in an ultralight scalar, which is consistent with the data that we have. Okay, I'll finish there, and thank you all for listening. Yeah, so that is consistent with this story, right? So the axion B lensing still wants this high value of S8. So it's in the same story. It pushes to slightly smaller scales than what was modeled in the Planck data, but it's still measuring these linear scales. Yeah.
I've got a very general question. So when you call this wave dark matter, does it mean they're going to propagate in some direction and create some kind of anisotropy? I think the latest slide where you had a hydrodynamical simulation, I felt there is a kind of direction in oscillation.
Yeah. So generically, yes, right? So, you know, especially in a filament, right? So the thing isn't collapsed along the filament. So you only have these fringes in the radial direction of the filament. So there you would expect to see some sort of anisotropy. Within a halo, you have, the one way of thinking about it is there's these granules of dark matter which are oscillating. And there I think spatially would average out. But definitely in regions like filaments, you would see some anisotropy, yeah.
Questions? Let's thank Kira one more time.